Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 450th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. So, taking us from where we left off last time, we're looking at the Peer Umbrella Systematic Review that was published in March this year, 2020, in Canadian Family Physician. And with us today, we have the two lead authors, so Joey Tan and Danielle Perry. And I'll let them speak in just a minute, but I'm going to catch us up. So this is a huge piece of work done by the peer group. It includes people, which I'll quickly review, Betsy Thomas, myself, Adrian, James McCormack. I don't know who he is. He's kind of a hanger-on. Yeah. Mike Colbert, Scott Garrison, Sam Mo, Roger Craig, Nick Dugray, Karen Chan, Caitlin Finley, who's been with us a lot. You've probably seen our publications with her, and Rhonda Ting. And then, of course, Tina, our fearless leader. But what we reviewed in the first few, in the first podcast, was exercise, with about 47% of people benefiting from exercise versus 21% for osteoarthritis patients. Intra-articular steroids, with about 50 versus 31% benefiting. And the second number is in the placebo group. And for SNRIs, which is really only duloxetine, was 64% versus 43%. So these drugs were all between 4 and 6 number needed to treat for benefit. And the only caveat is, as far as the intra-articular steroids go, they're short-lasting, which Danielle reviewed for us. So now we have to pick up where we left off, and that is on oral NSAIDs. So I'm going to hand things over to Joey to take us through that, and then we'll alternate back and forth with Danielle.
All right. So when we looked at oral NSAIDs came out the most, had the most RCTs with it, 43 RCTs with about 29,000 patients. So you must be thinking, you know, NSAIDs, it's dynamite. It should be something we're using. In terms of the benefits, what they found was 57% of people reached a 30% improvement on an NSAID versus about 39% with the placebo arm or control arm. And it ranked fairly high in all of our interventions with the number to treat at 6. But when we actually look deep into the evidence, it was surprising, because a lot of the times when I'm out in the pharmacy, I see a lot of traditional NSAIDs. So those are things like ibuprofen, naproxen, being used for osteoarthritis. Whereas the majority, actually, at least 90% of the evidence falls with the COX-2 inhibitors. So those would be things like celecoxib and rofecoxib, which I believe was discontinued a number of years ago. So it's kind of interesting in that the evidence lies with the COX-2 inhibitors, but oftentimes when we look at guidelines and what we use in practice are more so the traditional NSAIDs. So when we actually just looked a little bit more into the traditional NSAID groups, there's maybe a handful of trials, and it showed relatively similar numbers as the COX-2 inhibitors in terms of efficacy. I don't think it's something that, because it has a little bit of evidence, doesn't mean that it you shouldn't use it at all, because it falls right into the same realm as those COX-2 inhibitors. I think some of the benefit is, and the thing is, I graduated after rofecoxib was discontinued, as all of the issues with cardiovascular problems or side effects with the COX-2 group. Do you guys have any comment on that?
Well, I will comment first by saying that you graduated after rofecoxib was pulled off, and James has been in practice before NSAIDs were invented.
Yeah, we just used to rub willow bark on our joints.
Just to put some context there. Sorry about that, James. That
no, but the issue, it's an important issue, because you're going to, here's sort of the way to think about it. Do a lot of people have osteoarthritis? Absolutely. Is it a huge market? Absolutely. So you're going to get a lot of, especially a new medication, if it's a new NSAID, that's going to be the population you're going to study right away. Because one, they probably do have an effect. And it's a relatively easy group to get lots of people into it. And so the issue always does comes down to, is one are all NSAIDs the same? I still believe, I think it's really difficult to choose between any of them. And I almost always just say go on the basis of cost. I know there's a debate about that. I know there's, you know, you can argue one way or the other for safety with cardiovascular and GI and so on. But, you know, they probably are, for lack of anything else, they're probably all equally effective. I'm sure you'd probably agree with most of what I said, Mike, although I know you, there's some stuff around adverse effects that you might want to comment on.
Yeah, and I think Joey can chime in too. The adverse event profile, like these drugs, and we'll talk about the KT stuff later, but we didn't put them up quite as high as some of the other interventions because they have harms. They have renal harms. They have, and any of us who've been in practice for a little while have seen the effects of NSAIDs can have for some patients on their renal function. They also have risks for cardiovascular disease, and that's what hurt rovecoxib. But it was kind of a, I think, James, you'd agree, it was a bit of a fall guy because many other NSAIDs have that risk. The one that may have the lowest risk, and that's a strong may, but
yeah, exactly.
If you were guessing, it would be naprosyn is the lowest risk. But that doesn't mean it's safe in other ways. So it has a GI risk just like many of them, and maybe the COX-2s have it slightly less in that arena.
Yeah, and the cardiovascular is tricky because I would suggest that they all have the potential to worsen heart failure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's through their renal impact.
Yeah, exactly.
They all have that curse. So that's where these drugs kind of stumble. It's not that they don't work and all of that stuff. It's that they, well, for some people, they won't work. That's that we need to be honest about that. Yeah. But the biggest issue is that they have harms more so than, for example, the corticosteroid injections. Mm-hmm. So that's really where they struggle. But it doesn't mean that they don't have a place in care. It's and this is not the time or place for us to review it because we have reviewed it here. But all the options available for you to minimize the risks of NSAIDs, like choosing naprosyn, and then how do you protect the stomach? Whether you test and treat for H. pylori ahead of time or whatever. But we've presented that before on the podcast, the options of how to manage it. But they work and they've got harms. So that's the challenge with these ones, where the exercise and intra-articular corticosteroids have benefits with very little harms.
Yeah, and I haven't, I've been very good. I didn't mention it last podcast, but I do right now have to talk about dose, Mike.
Bing!
There we go. And the reason I have to say that is because these are medications for which we don't really know the right dose for an individual, and we just need to let people figure it out. And at least in my clinical experience, although it's been a few years since I've been doing that, but is that a number of people can get away with much lower doses. They can, but there's no way of figuring it out. Do you need to take them twice a day, once a day? I know a number of people who, from a perspective of osteoarthritis, could get away with, you know, using them every 2 to 3 days on a regular basis, and it works for them. And so, you know, probably the lower dose, the less you use, likely the lower risk of side effects. But I don't, and Joey, you could mention this. I don't think there were, I mean, I'm pretty sure all of these studies were pretty much fixed doses for, you know, looking at outcome. They weren't sort of titrated. They weren't titrated.
Yeah. So oftentimes, the ones we commonly use, so celecoxib and some of the traditional ones, were very set doses. They didn't look at low dose, medium dose, high dose.
Yeah.
The only one that did and is rofecoxib. For whatever reason, rofecoxib had like a ton of data on adverse events. They had many trials with varying arms of doses. And it's the one that was discontinued off the market. So but interestingly, what rovecoxib did find was that the dose didn't vary as much between them as much as someone might think. It's kind of the bottom line there.
Yeah, and like I said, you can double the dose of an NSAID. That doesn't mean you get twice the effect by any stretch of the imagination. So that's just the caveat is, if you're going to use NSAIDs, allow the patient to control the dose. Hopefully they'll get to a lower dose, and we'll talk a little bit about it, let them know about the side effects and go from there. Anything else you guys want to add on for oral NSAIDs?
Nope. I think we're ready to move on to glucosamine.
Yeah.
That's
Mike's favorite topic.
Yeah, I love this drug.
All right, so glucosamine, I guess, seems pretty reasonable. I think that's why we pulled it in here, because I think a lot of practitioners probably have patients coming in asking about it. You can get it over the counter, so there may be some patients who just heard from their friend of the friend that they're taking glucosamine, so now they're taking it. So we really wanted to see, was there actually any good evidence for benefit for glucosamine? And I guess falls into one of the categories where it's more natural, I guess, especially compared to NSAIDs, all of these effects. So anyways, what we found were 9 randomized trials with about 1,600 patients. And these patients were followed for about 4 to 156 weeks. So very, very wide range. And then at first glance, when we meta-analyzed all the data, it looks like it's kind of working. So again, as we're going through these, we're getting to the ones that have less and less benefits. So for glucosamine, we found about 47% of patients receiving glucosamine had benefit versus 37% receiving placebo, kind of typical what we've been seeing for placebo. But then when we start looking into it a bit deeper, so this was kind of our overall meta-analysis. And like I mentioned before, we start looking at industry funding, publicly funded. This is probably something you guys have talked about on the podcast before, where sometimes industry funding will design a trial in a way to show benefit, however they design it. And unfortunately, when we looked at glucosamine, that seemed to be the case. So when we looked at just publicly funded trials, probably the more clean trials, there was actually no benefit. And when you actually look at glucosamine broken down by time point, so when you look at them for studies that are less than 4 weeks, 4 to 12, and greater than 12, there's actually no benefit at all at any of the time points. So when we do get to the decision aid, you'll kind of see that glucosamine falls under this unclear benefit, because when you actually start accounting for some of these differences between trials, the effect seems to go away. In terms of adverse events, since we just pulled adverse events from systematic reviews, there really isn't anything reported for glucosamine, so that's kind of an unknown. But yeah, that's kind of what we know on glucosamine. Kind of looked like it, but probably doesn't.
Yeah, so this is kind of classic for glucosamine. The Cochrane review that looked at broke up trials by quality and looked at, for example, often is used the sentinel criteria of allocation concealment, and they found that those studies had no effect. And I always use that when I'm teaching about meta-analysis, because it's a perfect, all of the studies line up perfectly on the no effect line, where the effect estimate is actually right on the no effect line. Like this research is demonstrating really, really clearly that it doesn't work. So yeah. The higher quality studies, the publicly funded ones aren't showing benefit in this case. And it's interesting, the adverse event profiles are the same way. The glucosamine has, just as it may be having no effect, it's not having adverse events either. It's similar to a small glass of water if you're only moderately thirsty.
Just a $10 glass of water.
Yeah.
But it sort of reminds me of that. Remember the line that our friend and colleague Bob Rainer said, a drug without side effects is a drug without an effect.
Yeah. Yeah, it works both ways.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so glucosamine, if your patients are finding an amazing benefit from it, knowing this evidence, I don't try and talk anyone out of it, because it's inexpensive and relatively harmless. If they say to me, you know, it works for me, do you know, like, is it effective? Do you recommend it? Blah, blah, blah. I'll say, well, I don't generally recommend it, because the research is that it doesn't seem to work. But if it's working for you, that's great.
And that's why, and we'll be talking a little bit more about this, in the placebo group, just under 40% of people had a benefit. So yeah.
A good benefit.
A good benefit. And so when you hear people say, oh, it really works for me, they are not lying, but they may be may have nothing to do with the glucosamine. So that's, you know, that's where you get, that's why anecdotal reports of glucosamine are next to useless, because of course you're going to have anecdotal reports, because 40% of people will get a meaningful response from the placebo group. So that's the sort of nuance that's so important.
Right. And it's not just that placebo pill, which we've talked about a ton. No. Even in the exercise studies where they were just being told, you don't get the good stuff. Wait, so you just have to sit in this group. 20% of them got better.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a natural, it's a natural fluctuation of the condition.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of stuff going on there. So just when patients are saying they're better, it's not that they're easily deceived or anything like that. It's lots of variables are at play, but we've talked about glucosamine. I think topical NSAIDs is our next one. And I think Joey, are you on the block for that? Or is that Danielle too? That's Danielle.
So very, very similar in terms of there's lots of data out there for topical NSAIDs. So 22 RCTs, just over 7,000 patients. A little bit different in terms of how many people got better. So 61% of people receiving topical NSAIDs did get better. 47% getting placebo had a meaningful pain relief. And I think it's really interesting to note that when it comes to placebo effects, typically in the literature, we see even a topical agent seems to give a higher placebo response than an oral pill. So just that process of putting something on your skin will actually increase the placebo response. And this correlated with that 100%. So if you're comparing that to oral NSAIDs, their placebo response was 39%, so versus 47 in topical. So a higher placebo response, mainly in terms of what were they using. Mainly diclofenac was probably the most common one. And in terms of concentration, like we've looked at this before, there really isn't a good idea of what concentration for these agents are better. The most studied for topical NSAIDs was about 1-2%. I know that there's compounding pharmacies that will do 10%. I've seen that. I don't know, Joey, if you know of anything higher, but I know I've seen some of my patients on 10%.
So I mean, I've seen everything under the sun from like 15% to 20. I think as long as the powder goes into the gel, they'll do it up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, some people
it still stirs in.
Yeah, some people just take a tablet and rub it on their knee. I'm by the way, I am joking. I have not seen that. That is not a recommendation.
Compound it at home, just melt it up and rub it down.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't think there's not good evidence to know which percent is better, but typically in these studies they were lower percentages, which are more available over the counter, whereas the higher percentages they need to be compounded. Nothing really else to add. Like, all of these are industry-funded trials, but it seems like NSAIDs are working. The difference, too, between topical and oral would be the adverse event profile. So more for topical are those skin reactions, so some sort of skin irritation, rash. There was a small number that did withdraw due to adverse events with topical, so I think the number needed to harm was about 50. So but again, compared to like more systemic effects with oral, I think topical, same amount benefiting, just less harm.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, James, these studies are mostly, just to let people know, where sometimes there's a mix. It's mostly knee OA and most research in this area, but some hip. In these studies, it's almost all hands and knee.
Yes.
And I think it's important. So in this systematic review, we typically did not look at trials that did head-to-head comparisons.
Yeah, so, that's right.
And I'm sort of going a bit from memory. Most of the studies that I've seen that have compared, there have been studies of NSAIDs topical versus NSAID oral, and you can't tease out a difference of effectiveness.
No, you can't. You can't. They're the same, or very, very close.
Yeah,
close enough. Difference. Yeah. So it's fascinating the topicals, because I've heard people say they don't work all the way to they work like dynamite, but there's obviously truth in the middle there.
Yeah. And so, you know, and it also gets to the point where it's tricky to know what to recommend, you know, because if let's say a person comes in with terrible osteoarthritis, every joint hurts, you basically would have to sit in a vat of topical NSAIDs. Now, with the caveat, there may be some systemic effect, because there is systemic absorption. And
absolutely,
you know, trying to, and I've read different numbers around that. anywhere from
the one that I always quote is 10%.
Yeah.
I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the number I was going to say. Maybe I heard it from you, but no, it's, you know, but I think it varies. I mean, I think some, you know, anywhere from not much at all to maybe a little bit more than 10%. And so, you know, we can go back to the dose thing. Maybe if you're getting 10% of it in your body, maybe that is one of the reasons. So, and I think, Danielle, correct me if I'm wrong, I think roughly speaking about 10% of people, depending on the product, will have sort of a skin reaction to it above and beyond the actual vehicle that's being used. But again, that's very patient specific, and you can switch between products and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a few systematic reviews that reported numbers in that range, mm-hmm. some that were reaching statistical significance. Yeah. I think it really just depends on the product, the person. Some people have really sensitive skin, so I can imagine them reacting, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
James is a very sensitive guy.
Yeah, but not skin.
But let's move on from that. Chondroitin and viscosupplementation. I think you're going to handle that for us, Joey.
Yeah, yeah. So just a bit on chondroitin. 9 RCTs with about 2,500 patients. And what they found was about the intervention arm, 57% of people achieved a 30% reduction, whereas it was 45% in the placebo. It was statistically significant with the number needed to treat of 9. But the issues kind of fell into the same realm as glucosamine, whereas the majority of these chondroitin trials were industry funded. And when you look at just the publicly funded ones, they didn't demonstrate a statistical significant benefit there. So we kind of group them into the same realm. You know, if a patient finds it's working, I think reasonable to kind of continue on, because adverse events were similar as well. There was very minor, very little adverse events with chondroitin.
Yeah. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think we look at the combination of glucosamine and chondroitin, because that's not an uncommon product. I mean, you basically can't walk into Costco without tripping over, you know, the 50 million bottles of it that are sitting right there at the entrance.
Yeah, no, it's something we did talk about. We didn't look at it in our systematic review, or isn't reported. But when we kind of did a little bit of digging on that topic, there's actually one really well done RCT that came out of the New England Journal that looked at glucosamine alone, chondroitin alone, mm-hmm. Chondroitin and glucosamine together, and compared them to placebo and celecoxib. What was the kind of results, bottom line there, was celecoxib worked the best out of all of them. And it was interesting, the individual agents of glucosamine and chondroitin were fairly similar. The combination, slightly better, but nothing to write home about. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where the combination kind of falls.
Yeah. In all of. And I know one trial that's not here that I was familiar with, because a colleague of mine did it here in Vancouver, was they took, and I thought a really interesting trial, because I mean, this debate about glucosamine and chondroitin has been around for a while. But what they did is, this was with the Arthritis Society, where they took a whole bunch of people who swore on a stack of whatever religious book you want that this glucosamine chondroitin was working for them. And they randomized that population to either continue with it or take placebo, and they found no difference. So a really cool little trial to go, I'm glad it's working for you, but we pretty much know it's not that. You know.
Wow.
So always interesting. So that's what we know about those products. Now, viscosupplementation, because I know that is quite popular. And, you know, we're talking in, you know, the steroid injections, I don't know about the cost here. They're probably about 40 or 50 bucks sometimes, depending on where you go. But these can be upwards of, you know, the $400 to $500 an injection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And the viscosupplementation just gained a lot of traction. There's so much out there in terms of RCTs. You found 31 of them with a responder type outcome, 6,000 in terms of patients. And it came out towards the bottom of the pack of all these interventions we've talked about, whereas 53% of patients with viscosupplementation found a benefit versus 44%. It was statistically significant. With a number to treat of 11. But again, when you look at just the publicly funded ones, no benefit was found when you just look at the publicly funded trials. And, you know, viscose supplementation, we bring this up a lot in a few of our talks and into groups, and it usually gets, we get the most flack for viscose supplementation because, you know, maybe they didn't inject it properly, maybe there wasn't a proper routine. It kind of falls into a similar realm of platelet-rich plasma. It just this idea that, you know, it's got to work. So that's why there's just so many RCTs on them. It's just people really want it to work.
Yeah, and if you use it, about 4 out of 10 people will report a clinically important benefit, and that's that's just in the control group. So and Mike, I know probably all of us, I certainly know a number of people who, again, swear that it works really well for them, and I'm the same way. Now, I also go, boy, I hope it does, because it's expensive. Like, you know, it's not, although I guess a single injection of that, by the time, if you have, you know, if you took glucosamine or chondroitin for 6 months to a year, I still don't think it would get up to that price, but it's an interesting one, because people swear by it, but all we can do is report what the evidence shows.
Yeah, and so I just looked at the price, and this is from a little while ago, but $285 to $500 for 1 to 3 injections. Yeah. So it's, you know, and also we know that when you pay for something, when something's more expensive, we're more likely to believe it works. There's been a bunch of research that shows that. So knowing that you're getting an expensive intervention helps with this product, particularly not in the clinical trial so much, because you don't know what you're getting there, unless there was unblinding occurring. But in our real life practices, when patients say this works for me, we know that just knowing the cost of something, knowing that it's expensive, increases the effectiveness. That's been studied in pain. It's been studied in Parkinson's disease. And it just shows that in all cases, it shows that the more something costs, the more effective you think it will be.
Yeah, which is Mike, which is when you see patients, Mike, right? You ask him, can you give me $500?
Yeah, you're gonna get dynamite.
Oh man, it's gonna be so good.
Yeah, but we all know that's a deception.
Yeah. So speaking of dynamite, or the opposite of, let's go to opioids.
Yeah. So I feel like a lot of people would expect opioids to be at the top of the list, but it's almost at the bottom. So, right, this is kind of the last one that actually showed some statistically significant benefits. So, in terms of what we found, 15 randomized trials, just over 6,000 patients, and they were followed for as little as 10 days to 24 weeks. 10 days is always interesting because, again, we're dealing with chronic pain patients. So putting that out there. So in terms of how many people benefited, about 47% of those people on opioids had a meaningful benefit compared to 43% with placebo. So only a 4% absolute benefit. And again, just borderline statistically significant. So almost hitting that line of no effect with a number needed to treat of 32. So definitely not as beneficial as they seem. Obviously, all industry funded. So in terms of the quality and how they were done, pretty well to industry standards. Of course, it's interesting when you start looking at subgrouping and how things work. So when we looked at opioids in terms of how long they're on opioids, opioids actually had no benefit beyond 4 weeks. So the only significant time point was in the short term. So when it comes to a chronic condition and they're only working in the short term, is it actually a good intervention for a chronic condition? And I think that we're starting to see more and more that opioids, do they actually have a place with chronic pain? And I think our showed that maybe they don't, especially with osteoarthritis.
Yeah, and especially with the side effect profile, which I know you're going to talk about.
Yeah, so for side effects, not surprisingly, when it comes to withdrawals due to adverse events, they scored highest out of all the interventions. So a number needed to harm between 5 and 8 for withdrawals. Unfortunately, we only pulled adverse events from systematic reviews. So the main ones that we looked at were any adverse event, serious adverse event, kind of ones that systematic reviews typically latch onto. And most of them were statistically significant. So they're all higher with opioids. And then, of course, we know of individual harms with opioids, dependency being a huge one, and then some other, like, overdose, obviously really, really important. And then other ones that are obviously important, too, to the patient, like constipation, dizziness, all of those things have been shown in RCTs of opioids. So really a wide range of harms and a really limited window for benefit, if anything, when we have so many other interventions that showed significantly more benefit.
Yeah. And I would agree with you. I am, and I'm sure Mike or Joya, I don't think they should be used. I mean, I think they've got a greater chance of harm than benefit. And
like a way better. Like, I think, James, that needs qualification. The chances, when you look at this literature that we've accumulated here, it's not just, they're not even close. And as Danielle put it, at kind of beyond 12 weeks, and it's not like there's not enough data. There are a dozen or so RCTs in there. Mm-hmm. And when you pool them together, there is no effect after 12 weeks. It's deeply concerning to me, the place we got to with these, mm-hmm. when they're so ineffective. And James, you want to tell just a little bit, it's like a teaser for some of our next systematic reviews, but you've been looking at these trials and just how they're designed is fascinating.
Oh yeah, no, it's fascinating. And not for, and it's not every trial, but you know, a lot of the studies, these drugs are so not tolerated that what they will do first off is they'll do a run-in trial and you have to sort of tolerate them and have an effect, and then we'll randomize you. And so it's a bit of a gong show when it comes to that. So I think, you know, when we're saying that there's a, what would you sort of say, there's a about a 3% or a 4% absolute difference, that's if you look at it in a good light.
That's the best it can possibly be.
Yeah, it really. So I would suggest that they likely have virtually no benefit, and absolutely, you know, we're talking at a minimum, I think 10 to 20% of people will develop some adverse events from it, especially if they take it chronically.
Yeah. And again, like, the effect disappears after 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So you really have such a small window of benefit, and then that's if you're not already getting harms right from the get-go. Yeah.
Now, the only thing I'll say in defense is that you also build up some tolerance to the adverse events. But that's really an unacceptable answer. You know what I mean? Is, you know,
the least I can do is absolutely nothing, but yeah. I'm going to go you one better.
Yeah, exactly. So that's that. And I'm sure that's many of the treatments that we talked about, but there is one that we haven't talked about. And for those of you who are following along in your playbook, you're probably wondering why we haven't talked about it yet, or where we're going with this, because probably the number one product recommended by most healthcare providers is good old acetaminophen, paracetamol, and dare I say, Tylenol.
Yeah. And I'm about to disappoint you all.
it won't, Danielle, it won't be the first time or the last.
That's what I do now.
I know. Yeah.
So we, of course, went into it expecting to see a ton of data for Tylenol. Basically came down to two trials looking at Tylenol with about 900 patients, followed for 6 to 24 weeks. And pretty much every way we looked at it, every way that we spun the data, there is no difference between Tylenol and placebo whatsoever for efficacy. Both of the trials were well done and industry funded. So you'd think industry funded maybe would just push a little bit towards benefit, but no, it was literally nothing, right in the middle. The confidence interval literally falls in the middle of no effect. And then, of course, you have the abnormal liver function adverse harms that so not only do you get no benefit, you may also get some weird readings on your liver panel. Yeah. So
now, fortunately, the chance of that are the chance of getting some abnormal liver function, and I don't even like the term liver function, liver enzyme tests, is actually pretty high, but that's just because they're high anyway, relatively speaking. Yeah. So it's really tricky to pick up. And one of the important thing, not the important, an important thing is they didn't squander on the dose in these trials. Like this is giving the maximum 1,000 milligrams every 6 hours.
Yeah.
So, you know.
They weren't cutting its limb. They were really trying to make it work, but.
There were 1,000 people, almost 1,000 people studied on acetaminophen for 6 to 24 weeks, and they were industry funded. That was enough. There was enough time. They should have shown a benefit if there's an important benefit there at all. And when it's interesting, because the other guideline groups have looked at this and they still recommend acetaminophen, not based on the fact that it works, because it really doesn't. It's based on the fact that they feel overall it's close to harmless.
Yeah,
I know. I remember reading that in a guideline and being like, wow, that's what the recommendation is based off of. Like, yeah. It's kind of like similar to a placebo. Like, that's what they basically...
They're saying, yeah. So they're taking the bar that we should set for efficacy of agents. They're digging a hole and burying that bar, yeah. So it's easy to step across.
Because I can come up with a whole bunch of things that don't work and that are probably harmless.
Yeah.
I mean...
That's right. May as well go get glucosamine.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Just sit down and listen to disco music. I don't know. Some people might argue. I would not, because I'm a child of the 70s. And... So I agree. That's a terrible bar to go after. And we've talked about this before previously, is that, you know, acetaminophen, and I'm as much to blame as anybody. And I am probably Mike, you too. We push this stuff and it doesn't work. Now, the good thing about it is it's about as effective as an opioid, but it doesn't have the side effects of the opioids. And so then you can even take a next step back. What about T3s? Now you've got two things that absolutely don't work.
But they don't work together.
They don't work together, but it does have caffeine in it. So who knows?
That would probably be the most effective.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I do want to point out, though, that there are studies of acetaminophen that it does have some effect for some things. I think for back pain, no. But for dental pain.
Headaches.
And even up to the point of migraines. There are pretty well-controlled trials that show it works for that. It just doesn't work for, at least in this case, osteoarthritis.
Long-term osteoarthritis pain. Nope, it doesn't.
We don't even know about short-term, but I mean, when we say osteoarthritis, we pretty much mean long-term, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So anything else that we want to bring up? Great job by you guys of doing that.
I was going to mention just a few of the...
Oh, yes, of course, I forgot.
Didn't have responders.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a couple smaller topics. So one thing, rubefacients. So capsaicin is the most common example of a rubefacient. One RCT, no difference. So we didn't find any evidence of that efficacy there. And then some of the other interventions that we couldn't find any responder data were things like platelet-rich plasma, counseling. Counseling, it's pretty much education on, you know, how to improve your osteoarthritis pain. We couldn't find any evidence on that. Cannabinoids, we didn't find any evidence on, and TCAs, so tricyclic antidepressants.
Excellent. Yeah. So now, if you guys are listening to the last two podcasts, you know all the best available evidence that's out there for different treatments for osteoarthritis pain. And in the next podcast, Mike, I think we'll go over the decision age that we talked about, and we'll try and we put a little bit of context to it, but I think we'll sort of wrap it up in a nice and put a nice bow on it.
Sounds perfect.
Great. So great job as always, guys. Thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.